I didn't know this person, but I once knew of a lady named Candace that married a man named Barr, B-A-R-R. And so she was thereafter known as Candy Barr. I don't know if that's apocryphal, you know, sometimes there's some really strange names out there. I once remembered a fun little news segment on the local news in a city that I lived in about 15 years ago. They pointed out that there was an intersection of two streets, Nixon and Blewett. So it was they showed a shot of the intersection of Nixon, Blewett. And so that's, you know, just another one of those fun little things. Have you ever seen something fun or entertaining or amusing like that? Just those little things pop up and you go, that is really curious. Or somebody's name that doesn't match their what they look like, you know, a little tiny chihuahua named Brutus or something. You know, you'd think of, you know, Ike or Brutus being this really big dog and not a little chihuahua. Or maybe the other way around. You know, Fluffy being, you know, a big German shepherd, the name for a big, big dog. In Joshua chapter 10, there is a story about a guy whose name doesn't match his personality. His name is Adoni Tzedek. Adoni Tzedek. It says, and it came to pass when Adoni Tzedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and her king, so he had done to Ai and her king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. I'll stop right there, and I'll explain this guy and his name. Adoni Tzedek, the king of Jerusalem. This, by the way, is the first time in all of the Tanakh that the city Jerusalem is mentioned by name. There had been many times previously, especially in the book of Deuteronomy, when God had told the people that you are to do this when you enter the land at the place I choose to place my name. At the place that I choose for the sanctuary and so forth, which ultimately became Jerusalem. But this, however, is the first time in all of Scripture that Jerusalem is mentioned by name. It's been inferred in other places. But this guy, Adoni Tzedek, is the king of Jerusalem, a Canaanite king. His name means the Lord of Righteousness. The Lord of Righteousness. You might remember from Genesis that there was a king that was at this place. At that time, the name of the city was called Salem. And the king's name was Melchizedek. Melchizedek, the king of righteousness. And he comes out and he makes a treaty with Abraham, and he becomes a picture, ultimately referring to Messiah. He's referenced again in Psalm 110, as well as in the book of Hebrews, this little obscure guy from Genesis. The Midrash points out that that all the people that were in Jerusalem were righteous. Well, I don't know if that's the case, at least in my reading, because we're told that this guy, Adoni Tzedek, is seized with fear because of what Joshua and Israel have done to not only Ai, this place that was known as the Ruin, but also to Jericho. Just as Israel had defeated Jericho and her king, so Israel had defeated Ai and her king, and this guy is quaking in his floor shines. This guy is scared because he's also heard that Gibeon has not only made an alliance, has not only made peace with Israel, but is even in their midst, has even joined them. Not just a non-aggression pact, but has come into the midst of them. Karov, they've come near Israel. And so verse 2 says, and he feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was even greater than Ai, and all the men there were mighty. Man, Adonai Tzedek is scratching his head, wondering, you know, why did Gibeon do this? They're greater than Ai. They're stronger than Ai. After all, Ai was, the word Ai in Hebrew means ruin. So, of course, I suppose most places would be stronger than that. But he doesn't understand if Givon was such a mighty city, why they would join up with Israel. Why they would not just make a peace treaty, but would come into their midst. Why, if they're so great and if they're so strong, that they would join Israel. Verse 3, therefore Adonai Tzedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Horam, king of Hebron, and to Piram, king of Lachish, and to Debir, king of Eglon, saying, come up and help me. Let us strike Givon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the people of Israel. Therefore, the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Yarmut, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered themselves together, went up, they and all their fighting men, and camped against Gibeon and made war against it. Note what fear has driven this king to do. Not only has he seen what Israel did to Ai and Jericho, but he's also seen the response of this guy that he thought was on their side, the people of Givon, and so he pulls together a coalition to go attack Gibeon. We got to bump these guys off. They are pursuing the wrong path. They're going after Israel, and he draws together a coalition of five kings. Because he hears about everything that Israel has done. Earlier in the book of Joshua, we see how the Gibeonites hear what God has done. We see how the Rahab says that she has heard what God has done. There is amazing power in hearing. It's amazing that in most of these examples in the book of Joshua, when somebody hears something, it motivates them to either a negative action or a positive action. It's just reinforcing in my heart the idea of the Shema. Did you know that when we recite the Shema, that that's actually a commandment? It's not a suggestion. It's not a statement of faith. It's actually a commandment. Shema is the in the imperative form. We are commanded. Israel is commanded to hear, to listen up. Listen, Israel. It's a command from God. Listen and love. We first have to hear, and then, and only then, can we respond out of a heart of love. There is power in hearing. Do you remember in our series through the book of Mark a couple years ago, that parable of the five kinds of seed, or was it four? I think it was four. Four kinds of seed. And when Yeshua describes and defines the story, he says, well, it's like people who hear the word. Some seed falls on rocky soil. It's like people who hear the word, but their troubles in their life, their anxieties, their fear, don't allow the hearing to take root. Or it's like seed that falls among thorns. This time, instead of the trouble being internal, it's external trouble. They hear the word, but then they fall into attack or persecution or trouble. And the word is choked out by these thorns. In each case, someone hears, but they do not respond adequately. Finally, in the last example, the person hears the word, the seed takes root, it sprouts, and it grows, and it produces a harvest. Hearing is very important. And these five kings hear what Israel has done, and instead of having a heart for to recognize that this is the finger of God working there, they want to rise up and oppose it. They stand in opposition. Fear drives opposition. It's funny sometimes that fear will even link people that are not previously associated. For instance, Genesis chapter 25, verse 18 says that when giving the genealogy or the descendants of Ishmael, it says that these 12 sons of Ishmael are at perpetual conflict with one another. But yet, when you get to Psalm 83, it mentions how they, together as one, the sons of Ishmael, stand together against God, against Israel. In Nehemiah chapter 2, 3, and 4, it describes a group of guys. One of them is a Amorite, another is a Horite, and another is an Arab. But together, although they come from separate identities, different places, divergent people groups, they suddenly can come together and agree on something. They can agree to attack. They can agree to fear. They agree to stand in opposition. And this is what's happened with these five kings in Joshua chapter 10. Fear will cause people that otherwise would not form alliances to stand together to oppose the mission of God and God's people. Psalm chapter 2, which in one tradition was actually the first psalm, we're told later in Scripture. The first psalm says this: "Why do the nations rage?" It's a poet looking at this attack that comes on God's people. "Why do the nations rage and the people plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers gather together." That's exactly what we're told, that these five kings, same word, they gather themselves together and they stand against the Lord and against his anointed one, that is, his people, the people of Israel. Why is that? This is a poem about anti-Semitism. Although the phrase, the word anti-Semitism, wasn't coined until the very late 19th century, coming out of the Dreyfus Affair in France. Alfred Dreyfus was a French general, military man that was actually highly decorated, but happened to be Jewish, and he was had a smear campaign that came against him, and ultimately, not only was he stripped of his rank, he was even persecuted and thrown in prison on trumped up charges, and the reason ultimately being was his Jewish identity. There was an amazing movie made back in the late 30s or 40s on this story, and at this second I can't remember the name of the movie, but I think it was called I Accuse. Maybe I'm wrong. By the way, ultimately he was exonerated and released from prison only after being in prison for about a dozen years. There was a young journalist there in Paris from Vienna covering the story, as journalists from around Europe did, and he wrote for his paper in Vienna. His name was Theodor Herzl, and Theodor Herzl, from this experience of Alfred Dreyfus, decided that something needed to be done to protect Jews. If in this modern age this could happen, by the way, for more than 100 years, Jewish people had been had full citizenship in France. France was the first country in Europe to give Jews citizenship, but yet even 100 years later, there was this remaining anti-Semitism, and the phrase anti-Semitism was coined during this time, following the Dreyfus Affair. By the way, Theodor Herzl, in his thinking, proposed, well, the Jews need their own home, where they can be self-governing, and thus the birth of the modern Zionist movement. Why do the nations rage? Why do they conspire? Why do they plot against God and his anointed? Listen to Psalm 83. Psalm 83 says, "O God, do not keep silent. Don't be quiet. Don't be still." Three verbs. Don't be silent, quiet, or still. "See how your enemies are astir, how their foes rear their heads. With cunning they conspire against your people. They plot against those you cherish. Come," they say. Ooh, that's the same idea that Adonai Tzedek said to his four king friends. "Come. Come," they say, "let us destroy them as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. With one mind they plot together And then it starts listing the places: Edom, the Ishmaelites, Moab, Gival, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, the people of Tyre, Assyria, Moab. These people, with one mind, plot together. They form an alliance against you. Whoa, 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 whoa. Didn't it say that with cunning they conspire against your people? They plot against those you cherish? Verse 3. Why then does, in verse 5, it says they form an alliance against you? God, don't be quiet, silent, or still. That is to attack the people of Israel. There is an attack on the God of Israel. God and his people are linked together. God and his people are linked together. There's an inseparable connection between the Jewish people, the people of Israel, and the God of Israel. You cannot separate them. There's a couple other aspects that form that link beyond the scope of the current discussion. But certainly, God and his people are linked together. Later, the prophets say, when it speaks of Israel as the apple of God's eye, Zechariah speaks of Israel, and when you touch them, you touch God, the apple of my eye. Didn't Yeshua himself say, what you do for the least of these, my brothers, you do for me? Well, who's Yeshua's brothers? Who is he looking at? He's standing there looking at the Jewish crowd around him. What you do for the least of the Jewish people, you do for me. There is a link between the Lord and his people. So when there is a conspiracy to stand, when fear draws people together, like that whole list of 10 ethnic groups in Psalm 83 that stand to oppose Israel, they are also standing to oppose God. God is invited into the mix. Well, let's continue in our exploration of this story in Joshua. In verses 1 through 5, we saw the fierce coalition. In verses 6 and 7, we're going to see the firm confederacy between Gibeon and Israel. It says, so the men of Gibeon sent a message to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal, saying, don't sit on your hands. Don't slack your hands from your servant. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the hill country are gathered against us. There's that gathered together idea. So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war, the warriors with him, and all the mighty men of valor. How is it that because Gibeon had linked themselves with Israel, they themselves had become a target? I think of a verse in Hebrews chapter 11. It's the by faith sermon. By trusting God, this one accomplished this. And by faith, this one did that. We come to the story of Moses, and it says, by trusting God, Moses refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Instead, he chose to be mistreated with the people of God. Well, wait a minute. Who in their right mind would make a decision like that? Who would choose to give up the favor of being the prince of Egypt to being known as Pharaoh's grandson, and choose rather to be associated with the people of God. The inference there for people of God is Israel, B'nai Yisrael. And very poignantly, the author of Hebrews says that Moses chose the mistreatment to stand with Israel. If Moses chose to stand with Israel, it was to choose mistreatment. And so when the Gibeonites chose to stand with Joshua in Israel, they've put themselves, whether they knew it or not at the beginning, when they came and made this fraudulent agreement, whether they knew it or not, they put themselves in the target. I think of Genesis chapter 12, verse 2. That is from the call of Abraham. God came to Abraham. Here's what God says. Go to a land I will show you, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you, I will curse. And through you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. I want to highlight the phrases right in the middle where it says, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. I've talked in the past how God gave Abraham and the Jewish people a partner to come alongside them, to help them fulfill their task. God told Abraham, the first Hebrew, God told Abraham, I am going to send you someone to walk with you. You need a helpmate, as God told Adam. And I've taught in the past that the call of Abraham mirrors the relationship of Adam in the garden. And I will give you a partner. I will give you someone to help you. I will bless those who bless you. In other words, someone else other than you and your descendants, the Jewish people. There will be those that come alongside that offer a reciprocal relationship of blessing. You will bless them. They will bless you. And together, you will accomplish the task, the work, the job, the mission that God has given to Israel, the Jewish people. Then it says, whoever curses you, I will curse. Just this week, it dawned on me that before God said, I will curse those who curse you, he first said, I will bless those who bless you. So if someone chooses to walk alongside the Jewish people in fulfilling their task, to walk alongside the descendants of Abraham and bless them, where are they when Abraham and his descendants are cursed? Well, they're still standing right there next to him. Are you following what I'm saying? First, God says, I will bless whoever blesses you, whoever stands beside you. Then God talks about the curses. Unfortunately, there will be persecution. God promised Abraham there would be anti-Semitism. The walk of Israel from the beginning was promised with that it would have potholes and difficulties. But if you choose someone other than the Jewish people, if you choose to stand beside Israel, if you choose to bless Abraham, you will still be standing there when Abraham is cursed. You yourself will endure potential hardship because of the struggle. And this is exact case that Gibeon finds themselves in. they've chose to stand with Israel. Well, they were actually entering into a covenant relationship treaty with Israel to save their necks. But beyond, unbeknownst to them, they end up standing there with Israel when the persecution comes. They themselves are attacked by those five kings. Note that the five kings don't come to attack Israel even. They come to attack those that stand with Israel. Whoever blesses Israel will be standing there when Israel is cursed. So they send a message to Joshua. They say, save us. Help us. I found a note by Rashi this week who comments that first they say, save us, and then they say, help us. One of my Bible translations actually flips that phrase and first says, aid us and deliver us. But it's interesting that they first say, save us. If salvation, rescue, deliverance is something that implies total support, total support. Teshua, by the way, we know our Messiah by the name Yeshua, salvation. Salvation is something that is given in total support. Help, on the other hand, is aid. It's partial support. It's, I'm going to come alongside you and work together with you. Whereas salvation carries with it the idea that you don't have to do anything. I will do all the work for you. And so the Gibeonites cry out to Joshua and they say, Joshua, we need you to come save us. Hoshea. Hoshea, by the way, it's the same root word as the name of Joshua himself. Joshua's name in Hebrew is Yehoshua. By the way, it's also related to Yeshua's name. We've talked about in the past the link between Joshua and Yeshua. They're one in the same name, especially in the Greek, Jesus. When we cry out for help to God to rescue us, He comes to provide total support. Salvation implies something that God does entirely of His own. I think the help is entirely His doing too. Because God often tells us, don't look to horses, to chariots, don't look to Assyria, don't look to Egypt to help you. Look to the Most High Himself. And so the Gibeonites cry out to Joshua, and Joshua responds. Do you notice that Joshua doesn't say anything? He doesn't send them a message back saying, you know, okay, I'll be there. You know, at 0700, he immediately mobilizes and with all his warriors and all his fighting men. It uses the word "kol" twice. Remember when they went to fight Ai the first time? They only went up with part of the warriors. Yeah, this is an easy. This is an easy battle. We don't need all our resources. Trusting in themselves instead of trusting on God. This time, it points out doubly sure that Joshua took all his warriors, all his mighty men, his mighty ones. And it demonstrates to me that in Joshua's mind, although this was a fraudulent treaty that the Gibeonites made, and Joshua knows it, in Joshua's mind, this is not just a treaty of submission. They've just not, it's not as if he's put his thumb under them and said, okay, I'll let you live, but you're trash. You just have to be my servant. That's not what Joshua's going on in Joshua's mind. It's not even a treaty of peace, of non-aggression. Okay, we'll let you live. You know, you're okay. I'm okay. We're all okay. We'll be friends. That's not even in Joshua's mind either. What's in Joshua's mind is a defensive alliance. Joshua immediately mobilizes Israel to go support those that have entered into relationship with them. Those that have chosen, though even fraudulently, to come stand next to them. Joshua is committing himself to their aid, support, their salvation. He's going to do all the work. And in fact, as you read the rest of the story, the Gibeonites aren't even mentioned. It's Joshua and Israel and the God of Israel that's fighting the battle. Joshua fully aids and supports those that he has entered into agreement and relationship with. How not only does Gibeon look to Israel for support, not only do they choose to stand with Israel, but Israel chooses to stand with them. It's a two-way direction in this story. Gibeon is attacked because they stand with the Jewish people. And in the same way, the Jewish people are supporting, are pledging and acting on their agreement to stand with the Gibeonites. It is a mutual relationship. There are still questions that we receive about Jews and non-Jews in this congregation. And repeatedly, I want to emphasize, I think I just did maybe about 3 weeks ago, but again, I want to emphasize, it is a mutual relationship. There's a difference in identity, but it is a common calling. Joshua responds to the Gibeonites to the threat of those that have gathered against them. By the way, I think it's interesting that Joshua knows what it is to be attacked. If you look back just one chapter at the beginning of Joshua chapter 9, you will find out that there was a coalition of people that wanted to come against Joshua, made up of those seven countries. It's the same seven that often shows up in Scripture: the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Perizzites, and I can't remember the rest of them. It's typically sometimes six, most of the time seven countries that are listed all the way back from the book of Genesis that are described. These are the people groups of the land. And here they show up in Joshua chapter 9 to oppose Joshua. They have gathered against him. And now these five kings have gathered against those that are in covenant relationship with Joshua. Joshua knows what it's like to be attacked. Certainly, to this day, Jewish people know what it's like to walk in persecution. They know what it's like to feel that pain. They know what it's like, either verbally or physically, they know what it's like. I was reading this week from the history of Tacitus. He was a historian writing in Latin. I found it very interesting to write what he wrote about the Jews of his time period. There's about three paragraphs in his history where he speaks of the Jews. And I don't have it here with me, but he goes on and on. He talks about how they do practices that we think are weird, are wrong, and we do things that they think are wrong. And even when proselytes, when people not of their people come in, you know, they give up relationships with parents and children and family, and suddenly it's sounding a lot like Yeshua talking. He's berating and making fun of our Jewish people. By the way, he uses the exact same language elsewhere to describe the early Christian believers. Did you know that in the first century, in the eyes of the Romans, there was no distinction between, call it Christians. That's actually that's a later word that was used. But the believers in Yeshua, there was no link in the eyes of the world between Yeshua followers and those of the normative Jewish community. Let me put it another way. Yeshua followers were just seen as a segment, a sect of Judaism, and they were treated that way by the Roman world. Again, those who chose to stand with Israel suffered the same consequences and in some cases endured the same persecution as Israel. In verses 8 and 9, we see the faithful comfort. We've seen the fierce coalition against the Gibeonites. We've seen the firm confederacy of Israel. Now we see the faithful comfort of the Most High. The Most High comes to Joshua and says those words that he's told Joshua on more than one occasion already. Fear not, for I have delivered them into your hand. There shall not be a man of them that stands against you. Therefore, Joshua came upon them suddenly because he had went up from Gilgal all night long. And the Lord caused them to panic before Israel and slew them. Well, it's rather graphic. This translation says, and slew them with a great slaughter. The Lord comes to Joshua and says, don't fear. There's a whole lot of reasons to fear. This perhaps was the largest, most powerful army that Joshua had ever encountered. Maybe the Amalekites, way back when they first came out of Egypt, crossing the Red Sea, that story in the book of Exodus, maybe that was stronger. But here we're told that God says, don't fear. But as you continue to read the story, God is the one that fights the battle. Remember, when someone attacks Israel, they are actually attacking God. To touch them is to touch the apple of God's eye. And now we know that whoever attacks those who stand with Israel is also attacking God. Do you see that? So to attack Israel is not only to attack God, but to attack those who stand with Israel is also to attack God. And so God fights the battle. God chases them for miles, actually. Chases them all the way from Beth Horn to Azekah and Makkedah. And it came to pass, as they fled from before Israel, when they were descending from Beth Horn, that the Lord cast great stones from heaven upon them, all the way to Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than from those who the children of Israel slew with the sword. It's almost as if Israel doesn't have to fight at all. There's a story in the Midrash that the stones, that the hailstones that God threw on those five kings and their armies were actually the hailstones left over from the plague on Egypt. We're coming up on Passover in just about 3 weeks. And it's a lovely story. This is the last time that hailstones were discussed in the Tanakh was at the plague on Egypt. And the Midrash reads that text very carefully and sees that the text actually says that the hailstones stopped. Moses went out and Pharaoh had said, "Oh, Moses, please stop the hail." And Moses went out and prayed and God stopped the hail. And in the sky, and even the rain quit. And so the Midrash asks the question, well, what happens if hail melts? When hail melts, you get rain. But the text in Exodus says even the rain stopped. And so from this, our sages derive the idea that, well, then if even the rain stopped, there were still hailstones in the sky. God hadn't sent all the hail because it just stopped instead of going away. It was like held in reserve in the sky, according to the Midrash. And now God let it loose again on those five kings that had attacked the people that were standing with Israel. God fights battles for those that love Him. He just doesn't come to their help. He comes to their rescue. Just as the Gibeonites had asked Joshua, "Save us and help us." They didn't say, "Help us first." They said, "Save us first." They were placing their full confidence in Joshua and Israel. They weren't saying, "We need your support." They were saying, "We need your rescue. You've made an alliance with us. We've come in to join you. We need your rescue." And that is what you and I need in our lives. We need the God of Israel to step in and rescue us. He is the only source. The Gibeonites had no one else to look to. Help wasn't enough. They needed Hoshea. Hoshea Lanu. They needed deliverance. They needed rescue. They needed Yehoshua to Hoshea. They needed Joshua to rescue and save them. That's what we need in our life. We don't need God to merely help us. We need God to rescue us. We need God to come in and do all the support. not merely lend his support to our strength. God promises he will do this. He will fight for us. He will go before us. He will stand with us. He will stand with those that also stand with his people, just as he fought that day for the Gibeonites. I'm sorry to say that persecution can be part of the game. Again, it's some of my perspectives on anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism, unfortunately, to me, is part of the game. It's part of what you signed up for. If you're not Jewish, and what you're promised if you're Jewish. Psalm 3 says this, O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? They are saying of me, God will not deliver. The word for deliver is Hoshea. God will not deliver. But you, Lord, are a shield around me. You bestow glory and lift up my head. To the Lord I cry, and he answers me from his holy hill. I cry, Arise, O Lord. Deliver me. There's the word again. Kumi Adonai Hoshieni Elohai. It's a beautiful messianic song based on those lyrics. Kumi Adonai Hoshieni Elohai. Arise, O Lord. Deliver me, O my God. Strike my enemies on the cheek. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessings be on your people. With the Lord, there is salvation. With the Lord, there is support. In the times of persecution, like Psalm 3 spoke of, God, my foes are coming against me. They don't think that I'm going to get any support. But God, I'm going to cry out to you for you to be Hoshieni, my deliverer. And because, God, there is no help from myself, I need your rescue. May he hear our cry.